This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
I mean, my growing up occurred at a particular point in history that when I look at young people today, I realize that they don't have the same basis. They neither have the economic security, nor do they have a movement.
And then I said, well, I want to go see for myself what's going on.
Because Uncle Sam sent me a letter when I was 18 that essentially said, here, boy, take this gun and kill those yellow people.
And in some ways, I feel very sorry for them. And then on the other hand, I tell them, you've got to build it yourself.
But things like 911 are just a wake-up call for people to realize that the emperor never had any clothes.
And that's something that I want to carry with me wherever I go.
And I said, if you don't want me to sit here and tell you what I was doing at 17 years of age, then I strongly suggest you build yourself an organization. So I don't have to tell you that at 17 I was in jail, okay?
Welcome. And this is another of our summer retrospectives. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller.
From our studio in Sebastopol, California, where we have just put away a large number of freezer containers of plum butter from our highly promiscuous plum tree. And this is a show about journeys.
Two stories today besides the plum butter. Several years ago, we did a series called Weavers. And one of our favorite visits was with Judy Claude, who'd been very active in the civil rights movement and then in a small community foundation in Philadelphia. So today, we present two generations of social activists and how they got that way. First, Judy Claude.
Who are the people the media call activists? Did you ever wonder about them? What makes activists so active? What do they do for a good time? In Philadelphia, there's a foundation called Bread and Roses Community Fund. We went there to check out activists.
Bread and Roses has made a commitment to fund those organizations that are working for social change. And by that, we mean that we fund groups who many times are involved in demonstrations and educational activities, advocacy work, etc., to try to change social policy. It really seeks out what we consider to be groups that are usually too radical or too small or too controversial to be funded by traditional foundations. Because most foundations look for a flavor of the day. And, you know, after a certain point, civil liberties and demonstrations were no longer the flavor of the day. So that's really the difference, I think, for Bread and Roses. How did I get involved with this? I grew up in West Philly, made a decision to go south because that's where the action was in 63 when I graduated. And swore to my mother that in my first year of college I would not be involved, would not go to jail, basically. I had to swear on a Bible, and in my second semester I was in jail. So much for that swearing, okay? And eventually dropped out of Fisk in Nashville and spent some time with Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and then came back to Philadelphia in 67. Finished at Temple in economics, and then did a lot of work around what was then the Black Power Movement, Pan-African Movement. Lived in Tanzania for 2 years. And then started working mainly in religious organizations at that point who were still fairly radical to do community organizing work and that kind of stuff. I grew up in a fairly nuclear family, okay? One sister, just she and I, she's older. Mom and dad, my parents divorced in 58, which was very uncommon at that point. But I had a really strong extended family on both sides. So it's like my grandfather, my father's father, came up the summer after my parents divorced and said to my mother, remember, if Chris at some point does not do child support or whatever he's supposed to do, you just let me know. We'll take care of that, right? I think my father lived under this threat all his life, okay? And so I think for my sister and I, there was security and there was never a sense of insecurity at all. Was I scared? We had been picketing this restaurant in Nashville, Tennessee. We had been picketing this restaurant most of the late March, early April of, I guess it was 64. And finally they moved on us. And the first time the cops moved, the line dispersed. And we literally broke ranks and we went around the corner and we had this long discussion because we had not come prepared to go to jail. And then we made a decision and we were scared because a lot of us in that particular demonstration were freshmen at FIST. I mean, our parents were ready to shoot us when they found out. And so we went back and knew that when we went back, we were going to get arrested. And we were arrested and next thing I know, we are all going to jail. And then our lawyer is going to jail. And then his friend, the other attorney, is going to jail. And then a couple other ministers are going to jail. And I look up and everybody's going to jail. And I'm like thinking, oh God, my mother is going to kill me. I mean, that literally was my first reaction. She is going to kill me. They housed us all in one cell, and had to be about 40 to 50 women in one cell, and then decided to intimidate us by housing in the cell with us women who were in there for murder. Except politics create different phenomena, and so the women were fascinated with the fact that we young people were willing to stay in jail. And we stayed for 2 weeks, and I came back to the dorm. And my mother must have had radar, because within 15 minutes after I was in the dorm, the phone rang, and it was my mother. And my mother didn't say hello. She said, "Were you raped?" That was her first question. I said, "No, Mom, but I got lice in my hair." And I said, raped? No. I mean, but that was because she had heard about what had happened to some of the women who had gone to jail in Mississippi and so forth. So that was her first concern. And later when I talked to my father says, "Please don't do this again. This really is not good for me." He says, "Your mother about drove me crazy." Okay. I don't know. I took a bite of the apple and I've just been nibbling at that fruit ever since. I mean, it's just been a real part of me ever since. And it is interesting to watch what has happened to all of us who came through the civil rights movement, because I think so many of us were able to find places where we could continue to do, quote, good. And yet we lost a lot of folk. I mean, we lost them either mentally and emotionally, or we lost them physically, okay, because we fail to understand that it's all right to take a vacation or it's all right to have some time to do some reflection. And it took me a long time. I used to think vacations was a bourgeoisie trip. I mean, you know, that you shouldn't do that. I can't wait to go on vacation, 2 weeks minimum, okay? I mean, it's taken me a long time to realize how important that is. Tanzania had a President Nyerere who had offered sanctuary to African-Americans who didn't want to go into the war. There was a large African-American community in Tanzania. It was also Dar es Salaam, the capital, was also the site of the OAAU, the OAU's Liberation Committee. So that meant that all the representatives of the liberation forces in Africa were based in Dar es Salaam. And so that whole exchange between Afro-Americans from the United States and the liberation forces from, you know, Guinea-Bissau, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, you know, Namibia, etc., that was a very rich and a struggle too, because we didn't always agree about certain kinds of things. And most of all, it was peace for a whole lot of us. And it was a time, and it was a chance to do some reflection about this country, okay, and about the struggles that I had been involved in up until 74. And so for me personally, it was a healing time. I remember crying for like, I don't know how many days. And the tears were just years of having believed in, you know, rapid social change and then realizing that change doesn't happen like that. And, you know, by 74, you began to realize that things were going to take a lot longer to change than you thought. And so it was a serious healing process, and I think that was true for a number of Afro-Americans who were living there. We also could see the weaknesses. So the idealism about Africa was stripped from our eyes. But also, there was a real appreciation of the reality of Africa, too. And I remember the Tanzanian family that I was very close to asked me why I was coming back. And I said, well, let me put it to you this way. I miss my tribe. I miss my nuances. I miss the way we talk, the way we walk. I'm going home. Okay, I mean, I never thought I would say that, but I'm going home. This is home. I mean, I'm an American, whether I like it or not. This is who I am. But there is something else that has raised my consciousness as well, and that has been two bouts with breast cancer. The idea of having cancer can be a defining experience in terms of enabling a person, and then particularly enabling me, to gain a finer appreciation of every single day. So every day becomes important and precious and a gift. And so you don't care about lying about your age anymore because you're just so happy you got there. In 1984, when I was diagnosed, I was just 37 years old. I mean, it was a frightening thing. And I remember my husband asking me, are you worried about being, you know, scarred or something? Because we were trying to make a decision about whether I get a mastectomy or a lumpectomy. I said, no, I'm worried about dying. I never even thought about the scarring part at all. Dying is what I was worried about. I mean, it was coming to grips with knowing that you finally don't have control. I talked about it. That was the other thing that was different, too. Because in my talking about it, I discovered so many other women who had had breast cancer, but who never talked about it. And I kept saying, well, what good are you if you don't talk about it? You got to talk about it. Got to talk about it. It's really important that you talk about it, okay? So that now, you know, it's nothing for women to call me and say, look, I want you to talk to my friend because she's really going through all these changes. She's been diagnosed with breast cancer. I keep trying to tell her that she's going to be all right, okay? And so you got to talk to her and let her know, okay? And I also think that it's also been important for me to know that my friends have not treated me any differently because I've had breast cancer. So there's very little sympathy, you know what I mean? It's like, they still demand the same things from me. I mean, this, you know, I can't use excuses or anything like that. Well, you know, I always tell people that you've got to understand history in terms of struggle, that you've got to have a historical perspective on struggle. I can say that at 50 now. So this is a nadir. And for those who are feeling very depressed, I keep saying, but we've been here before as a nation. And that period of time after World War II was the most unique period in U.S. history. I mean, we have not had that kind of economic dominance before. If we've not, you know, this is more like what's the real the U.S. And what, quite frankly, our groups do keeps me going, too. I mean, that I just figure that there are groups like the ones in the Delaware Valley all across the country who are doing things. I got criticisms of them in terms of being maybe too narrow and not thinking more globally, etc. But nonetheless, they're working. And I believe that out of the seeds of their work comes a new movement, and it'll probably be about 2010. Okay, you can quote me on that.
This was Judy Claude.
This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
When we first broadcast that interview on KPFA, we got an email from someone who heard it, and he sent us a poem. We asked if we could use the poem on the show. He said, sure, and we talked.
So we've finally come around to putting these two interviews together.
Cesar Cruz is 28, born in Mexico. We talked on the campus of Mills College in Oakland, where Cesar had been invited to teach a poetry class for a group of high school kids with Upward Bound. We talked outdoors under the bell tower, and then I sat in on the class.
See, I'm not a poet, I just write a lot. A poet is someone who has time to think about himself and to label himself. I don't have time for that. So Before we even begin, I just want to tell you a little personal testimony that poetry for me was the difference between life and death. And
I'm gonna I feel very blessed to grow up where I grew up. My father left when I was 2. I was born in Guadalajara, Jalisco, and I grew up with my grandparents. I learned to milk a cow. I learned to drink nata, which is the foam and the steam that comes out of a milk. But my childhood was wonderful. We didn't have a toilet. We didn't have much running water, but we were happy. No one had a toilet, and I didn't know what a toilet really was until I came to the United States. There's a place where a rooster's crow serves as local alarm clock. Education comes while milking an overprotective cow who will strike you if you approach your child. There's a place where Catholic saints come alive and the Holy Ghost gives grandma's arthritis entire days off. There's a place where grandpa works another man's land and still smiles after 16-hour days. There's a place on an unpaved road called memory where having nothing becomes a blessing. And in that place, callous hands salt tortillas and Holy Ghost believers crawl adorned with crowns full of thorns. Somewhere in that place, a man forgets INS Migra raids, television's hypnotic rays, and the constant spit in the face for being broke and uneducated. That place where roosters grow, cows protect their young, and hope grows faster than weeds, I once called home. My journey came, I was almost 12 years old, and I returned to Los Angeles. At this time, my mother had remarried. I felt lost here, and most of the students spoke English really well. I was transitioned to ESL programs. I felt really dumb, really awkward, and I didn't belong. I was fascinated by Atari, and I was captivated by these toys. I remember flushing the toilet over and over again, just amazed that, wow, the water goes down and it comes back up, and it comes back clean, and it doesn't smell. Also, I saw this writing on the wall, whether it was now what we call advertisements, or billboards, or tagging, but it was so much writing on the wall, and I felt like I didn't understand it, and maybe now it's like so many people were trying to express themselves, whether it's multinational corporations trying to sell something, or youth trying to say, I am here, I am standing, see me. I think years later it led me towards wanting to write and wanting to express myself and the stuff that was going on the inside.
Yes, there it is, there it is. You just added that, story of a people. Check this out. You can record the history of your block. You could record the history of what you've been seeing. And sometimes when you feel power, now, you usually have to check a box. And for a long time, it was black, white, or other. Most of us do not fit in that category, even if we're black, or even if we're white. Because black denies us all of our cultural heritage. Well, are you black from Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic? Are you from Egypt? Are you from East Oakland? Where are you from? And the same with white people. So when they put you in a box, they want to keep you there. Well, guess what? Poetry allows you to leave that box.
Immersed in ESL in middle school and in high school, I lived a double life. I was a scholarship boy, and I did really well academically. In my high school years, I went through an escapism where I just wanted to escape everything. Now I knew that we didn't have a TV and other kids had a TV, and I heard about a TV and all the lure and the luxury that a TV brought and all the wonderful dreams and images that it brought, and I knew we had nothing. I went to a high school with almost all Latinos, but no Latino education, and all of that, the way I dealt with it at the time was to escape, and I thought the best way to do so was drinking. Thankfully, I did really well academically. But no one in my family had ever gone to college. But I had heard a little bit about Berkeley and was fascinated by the notions of Berkeley and what I had heard, that this was a place where freedom was possible. My best friends were Anheuser-Busch, Coors, Tecate. And at the same time, I started seeing all this stuff that was happening on TV. I don't know what happened during that year. I don't know if it was reading Malcolm X's autobiography. I don't know if it was going to my first rally at Sproul Hall, April 29th, 1992, then taking over the 580 freeway, and finally we find ourselves at the Oakland Bay Bridge, and I by no means was a leader, I was a follower. And the next thing I know, I'm in Santa Rita jail, with organizers asking me, what do you stand for? Are you a socialist? Are you a Marxist? Not knowing who Marx was. I didn't know what I stood for. I thought I stood for, like I've said many a times, Anheuser-Busch. I thought that was the greatest thing, was to get drunk. I ended up doing 6 months in prison. Now we're going into my sophomore year of college. I had to withdraw from school. I didn't have a place to live. And I meet a man named Melvin Dixon. He takes me in and he says, you know, are you hungry? I said, yes. He says, well, can I feed you? Well, he takes me in and then I end up staying at Bay Area Alternative Press. And the first thing he hands me is the book by Asada Shakur and a cup of soup. And he's all, would you be willing to read this and write a review for our newspaper?
The reason we went on a hunger strike, the reason we went 13 days without eating, was because at that time they were trying to get rid of affirmative action. So we went on a hunger strike. On the 8th day of the hunger strike, I was so scared. I had never fasted more than 6 days, ever. And after the 8th day, I was talking to my mom, and my mom was crying. She was praying with me, and I was praying, and we were crying. And my refuge was poetry, as I wrote an entire book in 16 days. And poetry really saved me. And poetry was my food. Poetry was my nutrients.
Since then, I think since 93, I felt like I was going through a process of rebirth, and now almost a decade later, I'm still at UC Berkeley. I'm taking my final history seminar course, although I did walk in 2000, and my grandmother was able to come, and my mother was able to come, and walking through the history department at UC Berkeley, being one of four Latinos out of 200 that graduated from the history department, or at least walked, because my thesis was... I didn't want to make it 30 pages, it's now turning into 300 pages. It's the oral history of my grandmother and her experience migrating to this country during the Bracero program. But it made my family so proud. I had never seen them cry so much tears of joy to see me walk on that stage, and I thought a lot of professors were just full of it and this education system was lacking, and maybe it is. But for my parents, my mother who had me when she was 16 and never had an opportunity to further her studies, but always wanted to. My grandmother who had a third grade education, but wanted to continue her studies. This was their dream. And they were able to see part of them, part of their legacy, their heritage, their struggle, walk through the halls, or actually walk through the stage at the Greek Theater. And they were so proud. My return to Mexico, I was able to see my grandfather two times before he passed. One in 1996 when he was in a coma for 14 days. At the time, I didn't believe in a greater spirit. We hear the news that my grandfather has fallen and he has a blood clot developing in his head. And so we rush to Mexico, take him to the hospital. And my grandmother hadn't arrived. She had been at the church next door praying. And the doctors were telling me, they're all, we don't think he's gonna make it. Would you like for us to tell your grandmother? Or would you be willing to tell her? And I started crying, and my grandfather was next to me, and he had a hole in his throat. That's how we fed him. You know, he was breathing through the help of this machine, but through probably my most honest of prayers, I gave everything that I had, all my energy, all my will to the Great Spirit, and I said, Father, I can't help my grandfather. I wish you could take me. I wish you could take my energy, but there's no way I can tell my grandmother. About an hour later, as my grandmother, as she walks very slow, she's walking through this long hallway. It's bed after bed of sick people. Grandma's coming over, and my grandfather starts shaking, and he's shaking and shaking, and he begins to come too. So I'm screaming, and I call the nurse. The nurse comes over, the doctor comes over, and my grandfather comes too. We never had to tell Grandma. And those memories all kind of came together. Mom's immigration stories, growing up on the farm, thinking about grandfather in his coma in 96, seeing him one last time in 99. I'm 28 years old, and I felt like maybe it was time for me to become the man that I was supposed to be, thanks to all his lessons. He was honest, he was hardworking, he loved to smile and tell stories, and he made you feel warm inside. I believe that this generation has stopped dreaming. We've been pushed against a wall that we're fighting to save affirmative action, fighting to save ethnic studies and Chicano studies. Instead of just fighting to keep what was old, I really believe we can dream of something new. I'm very moved by my elders. I'm very moved by their struggle, by the fact that I've seen so many elders continue to fight. And I'm 28 years old, and I've only been, I say, fighting for 10 years. And sometimes during that period, I felt like I was burning out, and I see their spirit, and it refurbishes me.
And still are today. So I assume you'd rather me not wear a Cesar Chavez shirt, driving a car with Cesar Chavez stickers on Cesar Chavez Boulevard as I pass by Cesar Chavez School, but rather honor you with justice, fair wages, equality, and not just trophies, street names, and crumbs. Perdónanos, Cesar. Forgive us. I hope you'll stop turning into gay.
In Oakland, California, we were talking with Cesar Cruz. You can read his other poems and writings at www.brownpride.com/Cesar. Spell that C-E-S-A-R.
And we're out of time. Hitchhiking Off the Map is produced by The Independent Eye with funding from the National Endowment for the Arts.
And from the Hitchhikers Guild, which you can join by visiting our website, www.independenteye.org. This is Elizabeth Fuller.
And Conrad Bishop. Peace and joy.
One time he took me out into the fields and he taught me how to use a machete, and I didn't really know what I was doing. And I tried to chop down as much as I could, and I didn't really do a good job, but he looked into my eyes and said, "Mijo, me das mucho orgullo. I'm very proud of you." And that stayed with me. And I knew that I really didn't know what I was doing. And I looked at his side of the field and I looked at my side of the field, and there was obvious differences. But I miss the open space. I miss the fresh air. I miss that tree I used to play at. Most of all, I miss my grandfather.